Welkom bij de Ten Haven podcast. Ik ben Rick, redacteur bij de uitgeverij. En vandaag ga ik in gesprek met de Amerikaanse filosoof Michael Sandel. Zijn laatste boek, De Tyrannie van Verdiensten, is een aanval op ons meritocratisch denken. We bespreken waarom ons denken over succes zo destructief is, waarom het leidt tot de opkomst van populistische partijen en hoe in Duitsland zeer onverwacht iemand met een tegengeluid de verkiezingen won. We namen deze aflevering begin februari op, voor de escalatie van het conflict tussen Rusland en Oekraïne. Ook is de geluidskwaliteit iets minder dan je normaal van ons gewend bent. Excuses daarvoor. De muziek die je hoort is van Warnake. En vergeet je niet te abonneren op de Ten Haven podcast in jouw favoriete app. In your book, The Tyranny of Merit, you criticize the meritocracy in which we live nowadays. But what exactly is a meritocracy?
Well, The Tyranny of Merit is a paradoxical title because normally we think of merit as a good thing, as an ideal to aim at. If I need surgery, I want a well-qualified surgeon to perform it. That's merit in the sense of having well-qualified people perform important jobs. So how can merit become a kind of tyranny? Well, we can see this if we step back and look at our societies in recent decades. The divide between winners and losers has been deepening, poisoning our politics, setting us apart. This has partly to do, I think, with widening inequalities of income and wealth. But it has also to do with the changing attitudes towards success that have accompanied the rising inequality. Those who've landed on top have come to believe that their success is their own doing, the measure of their merit, and that they therefore deserve the full bounty that the market showers upon them. Now, this way of thinking about success reflects the meritocratic ideal, which simply stated is this: insofar as chances are equal, the winners deserve their winnings. Now, of course, chances aren't equal. Children born to low-income families tend to remain poor when they grow up. But the problem runs deeper, or so I argue in the book. The problem is in the ideal itself. Meritocracy is corrosive of the common good. That's its dark side, and that's what I try to interpret in the book.
And its dark side is that it's a danger for solidarity, I guess.
Yes. Meritocracy, the idea that the winners deserve their winnings, that their success is their own doing, this creates a kind of hubris among the winners and humiliation among those left behind. It leads the winners to forget the luck and good fortune that helped them on their way. It leads them to forget their indebtedness to those who made their achievements possible. And very often, it leads elites to look down on those less fortunate than themselves. So in these ways, meritocratic attitudes towards success are corrosive of the common good. They undermine solidarity. They make it difficult for us to see ourselves as citizens engaged in a common project with mutual responsibilities to one another.
And you write in your book that your students are also they're winners in this story, but you look onto them. Well, they're not guilty of anything. I mean, they're as much victim of this way of thinking as losers are, maybe.
Well, it's interesting. The tyranny of merit oppresses those who are left behind. That's the unfairness. But it also injures even the winners, because in intensely competitive, market-driven, meritocratic societies, even those who succeed, and they tend to be young people from well-off families who are able to win admission to top universities, even they are injured because they are subjected to a very intense set of competitive pressures, stress, anxiety, often from a very young age, is their parents do everything possible to encourage them, but more than encourage, to press them to prepare to compete for university entrance exams out of a sense that their entire lives will depend on the outcome. And so this, I think, leads to young people believing, first of all, that whatever they've achieved is the result of their own striving and their own effort. How could they think otherwise? But also that they feel judged by these pressures and expectations. And we see increasingly high levels of emotional and psychological and mental health challenges among young people, university age students. We see this in the United States, but also in many European countries, in the Asian countries, where there's tremendous emphasis on the university entrance examination. So in this way, the tyranny of merit also burdens, even injures, those who come out on top.
Yes, and that I found that so interesting about your book is that it's not only political philosophy, but it runs so deep in our society that it also, like you said, injures the psychological wellness of people. And what I found very, in a bad way, ingenious and so alarming about this way of thinking is the perverse logic that losers internalize.
Yeah.
They internalize that they lost because of their own wrongdoing in a way.
Yes. And this goes back to, I draw here on the person who invented the term meritocracy, a British sociologist connected with the Labour Party in the late 1950s, Michael Young. He coined the term meritocracy, and he pointed out that, of course, it's a good thing that the class system was breaking down, and now people from working class backgrounds were beginning to be able to compete for important positions and for educational opportunities. But he glimpsed the danger, the dark side, which is as we approach a meritocratic society, there is a tendency not only for the winners to believe that their success is their own doing, but also for those who are left out, for those who struggle to internalize this way of thinking about success and the harsh judgment that it imposes on them. If I'm not flourishing, then it must be my fault. My failure must be my fault. And the politicians in recent decades who have embraced a kind of neoliberal meritocratic political ethic have reinforced this inadvertently, because over the last four decades, mainstream politicians from across the political spectrum have said, if you want to compete and win in the global economy, go to university. What you earn will depend on what you learn. You can make it if you try. How many times did we hear these slogans? I call it in the book, I call it the rhetoric of rising. The idea of individual upward mobility through higher education as the response to inequality. Now, I think that's too feeble a response to inequality, but it also contains an implicit insult, inspiring though it may seem. The insult is this: if you didn't get a university education, and if you're struggling in the new economy, your failure must be your fault. That's the implication of the rhetoric of rising. That's the implication of a political ethic and a political project that says the way to respond to widening inequalities is to encourage individual upward mobility through higher education. One of the problems is most people don't have a university degree. About two-thirds of people in most European democracies and in the United States, about two-thirds do not. So it's folly to create an economy that sets as a necessary condition for dignified work and a decent life a university degree that the majority of citizens don't have. It's also a recipe for the resentment and frustration and sense of humiliation that has fueled an angry populist backlash against elites. So I think this ethic, this way of thinking about success, has contributed to the populist backlash against elites that is roiling politics in democracies around the world.
A new resentment.
Yes, and a resentment with a particular source and shape, having to do not only with the inequalities that neoliberal globalization produced, but with a certain justification for inequality. It's interesting, meritocracy began its career, so to speak, as an alternative to aristocracy, to inherited privilege, as an alternative to nepotism and unjustified forms of preference and prejudice and inequality. And so compared to hereditary aristocracies, meritocracy seemed like a liberating principle. Everyone will be judged and everyone will advance based on his or her talents. But today, meritocracy has turned out not to be a way to a more equal society. Today, meritocracy provides the justification for the inequalities that neoliberal globalization has brought about, because it tells the winners and losers alike that the results of the market reflect what people deserve, reflect what people have earned or failed to earn. And so we fall into the assumption that the money people make is the measure of their contribution to the economy and to the common good. This is an assumption that I think we need to challenge and reconsider, but it's an assumption that runs very deep in our politics and contributes to the resentment, to the toxic form that inequality takes in our time.
And you said that it is fueling populistic discontent and anti-democratic leaders. Do you think that we take our democratic system too much for granted?
I think we're beginning to ask that question with some urgency today, as we see threats to democratic institutions and democratic norms in countries around the world. We certainly saw that in the United States most vividly with the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. So there is a potent set of resentments and anger directed in large part against immigrants, against outsiders. There are racist sentiments entangled with these resentments. But I think it's important to see that along with these ugly dimensions of the resentments that have fueled the backlash against elites, there is also something else, a set of grievances that are more legitimate. And these grievances have to do with the economic but also social exclusion of large parts of the working class population as a result of the economic policies that have been embraced by the mainstream parties in recent decades, and also as a result of the somewhat patronizing, condescending attitudes that the credentialed classes and the professional classes, the well-educated classes, have toward those without a university degree. It's striking that today, one of the deepest political divides is between those with and those without a university degree. And if we look at parliaments across democracies, we find that although those with a university degree are actually only about a third of the population in most of our countries, they represent 85, 90, 95% of elected representatives in parliament. And so those without a university degree are essentially absent from the institutions of representative democracy. And this too is a sign of the market-driven but also meritocratic, credentialist-based way of thinking about success and about who counts. And it leads to the loss of social esteem for a great many working people. And this, I think, is one of the sources of grievance that has prompted the populist backlash against elites and against mainstream parties.
And in Germany, your ideas were picked up by a center-left politician, Olaf Scholz, who very unlikely won the election and became the new chancellor. You also did a public event together, I heard.
Yes.
And he won with respect as one of the main themes in his campaign. And I think that's something that has to do with what you just earlier mentioned, that people with a college degree without a college degree don't feel respected anymore, the working class or middle class.
Yes. Yes. Early in his campaign, months before the election, he asked for a dialogue about the book, which he had read, and he basically agreed. He thought that this lack of respect for working people connected to this meritocratic ideology and public culture was an important reason why center-left parties had lost the support of a great many working people. And he built his campaign themes around the idea of according greater respect to working people, to those without university degrees, and also around the idea of the dignity of work, which is the central theme of my book, The Tyranny of Merit. Because the alternative to a political project that emphasizes individual upward mobility through university education, the alternative is a political project focused on the dignity of work, asking the question, what can we do to reconfigure the economy and also our public culture to give some content and meaning to the dignity of work, to respect for the kinds of work that the working class does? I think during the pandemic, we've seen this very clearly. Because those of us with the luxury of working from home during the pandemic couldn't help but recognize how deeply we depend on workers we often overlook. Delivery workers, warehouse workers, grocery store clerks, childcare workers. These are not the best paid or most honored workers in our societies. But during the pandemic, we began calling them essential workers, key workers. So this could be the time for a broader public debate about how to bring their pay and recognition into better alignment with the importance of the work they do. And Olaf Scholz in his campaign was very much on to this theme. And he made it the centerpiece of his campaign. And he was able, the Social Democratic Party in Germany was able to recapture hundreds of thousands of working class voters who had abandoned the Social Democrats in Germany in the previous election. And this is a trend we see in many democracies where center-left parties that traditionally represented and drew upon the support of working class people, increasingly have become parties of the professional classes, of the well-educated classes. It's true of the Democratic Party in the United States. It's true of the Labour Party in Britain. And Olaf Scholz felt it was also true of the Social Democratic Party in Germany. And so he was able to reconnect, at least to some significant degree, with the working class voters who once
formed the basis of Social Democratic Party support, but who had abandoned the party in recent years. So it was really fascinating to see how this worked out in the German election.
Yes, and the same switch also took place in America with the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yes. Yes, by 2016, Hillary Clinton found that the Democratic Party had really become more oriented to the interests, to the values, and to the outlook of the well-educated, well-credentialed professional classes, and had alienated large portions of working class voters who turned to Donald Trump. We saw this also in Britain in 2016 with the vote for Brexit, when people with advanced degrees voted overwhelmingly to remain in the European Union, and people without a university degree voted in very large numbers to leave the European Union. So this divide between those with and those without a university degree reflects the meritocratic hubris that I write about in The Tyranny of Merit. And I think center-left parties, in order to revive their fortunes, will need to come to terms with this and will need to ask less about how can we provide individuals with the chance to rise, and instead, how can we contend with wage stagnation and with job loss and with inequality of social esteem by seeking a project of renewing the dignity of work?
And I think that the election in Germany are a very hopeful sign for this. I want to thank you for our conversation.
My pleasure.
Leuk dat je luisterde naar de Ten Haven podcast met Michael Sandel. Wil je meer weten over zijn boek De Tyrannie van Verdiensten? Kijk dan op www.uitgeverijtenhaven.nl. Wil je op de hoogte blijven van nieuwe afleveringen van deze podcast? Abonneer je dan op de Ten Haven podcast in jouw favoriete app.